Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 146 of Registry Matters. Larry, hey, when I listened to the recording last week, I was like, welcome to Registry, like my voice cracked, like I was a 14-year-old going through puberty.
I didn't notice that.
I didn't either until I went back and listened to the recording. But how are you on a fine Saturday night?
Fantastic. We had a wonderful balmy 92 or 93 degrees here today.
It's almost like I guess they call it an Indian summer. I wonder what the origins of that is. And does that actually, is that something that shouldn't be said anymore because it could be considered racist? Never thought about that until just now.
I would never use that phrase again in my life if I were you.
Yeah, I was like, hey, maybe it's an, oh, crap, I probably shouldn't say it. All right, so we will scratch that from, and I will bleep it out before this goes out to the world. Can I ask you a quick question about something political? And I don't want to charge up the political debate, and I didn't prep you for this. But I was having, I went and saw a movie today, and I was hanging out with some people that I'd never met before, and the individual that hosted the event was definitely left-leaning. And had a disdain for the current administration, but couldn't bring herself to vote for the other side, the opposing party, because she just finds him to be wishy-washy. And like, you know, he's old, which I totally get, but she just like, so she's abstaining from voting, which I was like, wow, that's a really bizarre position. You totally don't like the person in office, but you won't vote for the other person because you don't like him either. So you abstain from the process, which I find to be very odd, kind of like what we dealt with 4 years ago with Hillary. People just absolutely hated Hillary.
I wish I had an answer for that, because whether or not you like either one, which I have rejected that as being a standard, liking or disliking is irrelevant for me. Again, policy, public policy is what's important. Now, I realize that we're dealing with humans, and humans have these things about liking people. And I can't change that. But for a person to abstain from the process, you're going to be governed by someone.
Yeah.
And if you don't like the person, for whatever the reasons were that you articulated, age and wishy-washy and whatnot, someone is going to be at the helm. They're going to be making crucial decisions. I think we're facing one right now that was announced today. And I think that the head of state, in terms of who's going to respond in the middle of the night when there's a global crisis, there's all these decisions, and someone is going to set the tone for the prioritization of expenditure of federal resources. And you ought to be able to look at the bigger picture of how important it is for the person that's more aligned with your views to make that choice. So to abstain, I really think is just mind-boggling.
Yeah, I have felt the same. Anyway, yeah, so I'm not trying to go through all of the reasons of liking, disliking. And we talk about a lot on this podcast of looking at something in its totality. Like you could say, I don't like this politician because they made, we're going to talk about this later, but they made sex offender laws harsher. And I get that impacts our lives directly in a very negative way, most likely. But did the person do other things that would be considered gooder? So I don't know. I'm just, anyway, if you look at someone in their totality, maybe you can come up with an answer of what you should or shouldn't do.
Well, again, I'm going to jump in and say that I reject that. No person makes laws harsher by themselves.
Right. I totally understand that.
It's so ridiculously absurd to think that, and we'll get into it more in that particular segment. But we don't govern ourselves by one individual.
We do not. Absolutely, we don't have some sort of unilateral person makes it all the worst for us in one fell swoop. There was a whole thing of processes and things that went into getting us here where we are now.
Correct. We'll have fun with that later.
Okay. Well, let's start. You provided us with a couple questions from people along the different channels, like from actual like prison mail and other things like that. And the first one, I don't even know who it comes from Kathy, I guess. And it says it has to do with the BOP and access to email. And I I swear I think we've covered this halfway recently, but that there's some conditions that sex offenders in federal prison generally don't have access to communicating with the outside world via email, where the traditional, the normal crimes, I guess, they, you know, they put someone on their friends list, whatever, and they're able to do email conversations back and forth, but the PFRs are not.
Well, I think we did talk about it recently, and this is a question that comes in regularly. And what happened in this case is that the program statement allows each individual facility, I believe it would be the warden, but the facility to make the decision about which individuals they grant the privilege to, and they're considering it a privilege. And what I said when we last dealt with this is that those are administrative decisions, and privileges are not something that courts are going to disturb. And I don't see it any differently now, no matter how many times this question comes, and it will continue to come, because it should be in a perfect setting that people, regardless of their crime, we would strongly encourage and make communication and connections with the outside world as seamlessly painless as possible. And we would not do any restrictions except for upon an individualized showing of cause. But everything that this writer said about the reason why they have the blanket prohibition is the same thing could be said about the telephone. I mean, you can carefully monitor email electronically with all sorts of goodies that I can't begin to explain, but I know it can be done. And you can require that the person be pre-approved before you can email to them. I mean, you don't have to have an open end. I don't think you would just have to allow open email access to the whole world, would you?
No, I remember describing that with my kids' email, that you have to be within the school system's email system to be able to email the child's school email address. So I'm specifically talking within that own container. I mean, if he goes out and makes his own Gmail account, like, that's not restricted, but within his, you know, myschooldistrict.gov email, whatever, or EDU, only people within that entity can email my son. So by extending that, you as the inmate person would say, I would like to email my mom at mymom@gmail.com. And then those emails can go to and from. I don't see that this, I don't understand. This makes no sense as to why, other than them just saying no, this would be a thing. It would be so much easier to monitor electronic communications than it would be to monitor telephone or snail mail.
I would think so, particularly with the sensitivity with mail. I mean, well, they're getting tighter and tighter since this administration's been in power. At the federal level, they've gotten so tight that we can't even send anything with a label on it anymore. And it doesn't matter if it comes from a business or not. They reject it and say it's not acceptable. But
contraband, you can put like LSD or something on the back of the sticker.
The reason why I wanted to circle back on this is because people don't draw the connection. When you cast those ballots next month, you are deciding on who will administer the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Now, the president doesn't have any idea what goes on in the Bureau of Prisons. This one doesn't. The previous one didn't. Nobody does. But they set the tone for who they appoint to lead the Department of Justice, which the Bureau of Prisons is within that umbrella. And in terms of making things better for prisoners, that's something that you need to be aware of when you're asking for people's stance that are candidates, because Congress could put a lot of pressure on the administration, even though it's from the opposite party. Both Democrats and Republicans could put pressure on the BOP to allow more open access. As you go to the polls and make your decision between now and then, if you have a chance to be at a candidate's forum, particularly for any federal representative or Senate office, ask them this very question. How do you feel? Would you be willing to put pressure on the Trump administration to allow more access to modern communications, including email, for prisoners without the blanket ban, and see what they say? Now, they're going to do a dance around and pretend like they don't know what you're talking about, and they're going to say that they believe that contact with family members is a good thing, and they're going to try to evade your question, but say, well, specifically, to get my vote, will you commit to pushing for whatever it takes to allow, to force the BLP to allow more communication with families using all the platforms, including email. Force them, try to, don't let them do their little dodge, get them to say yes or no.
I almost have to think that this goes back to, God, I can't remember which senator said it way back in the day, where he said the internet is a whole bunch of tubes, and this is maybe in the 90s or something. Like, I would imagine, generally speaking, politicians are generally older, and they're not so savvy about how modern day technology works, that they are just scared of the new thing that they don't necessarily understand so well. It seems to be like this would be a carrier, like, everyone knows how the phone works, but this email thing, it's kind of like some voodoo magic. You press a button and stuff just shows up on your computer. And I don't know. It would be super duper simple to make it so that it's only text. So now you're not letting any sort of viruses or anything come in. And you can do all of the keyword filtering out the yin yang, like a spam filter, just gear it towards contraband conversations, you know, inappropriate conversations that someone may have. It seems like to me it would be super duper easy to do.
Well, I don't know enough, but it seems like that to me that if you could monitor phones effectively, you could certainly monitor these communications effectively. And I'm disappointed that the prohibitions are existing. But what I'm encouraging is, don't become optimistic that the courts are going to force the prisons to do this. We're going to have to do it through the processes of self-governance, through enlightenment of our elected officials, to put pressure on the executive branch who actually controls the Bureau of Prisons. Now, we're talking about federal. There may be many states that have email options available to their inmates. I do not know which states do, which states don't. But we're talking about, at this particular point, we're talking about the Bureau of Prisons. That's what this question was about.
Yeah. Let me, I think this hits home on a specific point. It says, the BOP itself encourages inmates to stay in touch with people on the outside, whether they be family, friends, religious advisors, members of the community, or other supporters. Such contact aids in rehabilitative efforts, improves morale, and provides emotional support for all parties. Support which is so often lacking for SOs and their loved ones. Messaging is superior in many ways to a telephone call, since it can be printed out and read or reread, does not require both parties to be available at the same time, and facilitates communication with loved ones who are speech or hearing impaired. Yeah, I didn't even think about that last part. You know, that's me being biased that I don't have to deal with it. But yeah, if you have a person that has hearing issues, whether that be the inmate or the mom or dad or, you know, other family members, maybe they can only, you know, maybe this would not only, maybe that's the best way that they would be able to communicate is through visual things, through reading.
Yeah, I like the arguments, but again, I'm trying to direct people towards, the courts are not your salvation for every bad policy, because sometimes there's a policy that's bad, but it is not unconstitutional. And the courts have resoundingly found all across the spectrum that prison privileges are subject to severe restrictions. And as long as this is deemed a privilege, you're not going to get very far in court trying to compel the privilege to be granted to you.
I have a feeling that this show is going to be the get out and vote, like voting matters. Because so what you're saying is your legislators have control over this, and then the executive branch has control over this.
Well, ultimately, the executive branch has the final control, but they can be subject to pressure. If some liberal do-good Democrat contacts the Department of Justice and says, I've got a whiny inmate that says they should have email, they don't care about that. But what they will care about is if they get a bipartisan of the 435 members of the House and 100 members of the Senate, if they get a significant number of those same, Mr. President, we're very concerned about it. Mr. Attorney General, we're very concerned about this. That can cause a change of policy.
I understand. I'm with you. Let's move over to a second email that we received. And this has something to do with someone that has been refused parole, who's been denied parole for refusing to admit responsibility for their crime. I have run into people like this, Larry, that 100% adamantly they are going to die on this hill, and they say, I am innocent of these crimes. And you go into your treatment program, whatever that is, inside or outside, and they say, hey, look, I need you to admit, you know, take responsibility for your actions. It would be really hard, Larry, to go, yes, I did these naughty things with this person. But you didn't do it. And I know that, like, you know, there's benefits on the other side, but now you're being, you know, I guess you're in that Hobson, whatever, that Hobson's choice. Anyway, the person continues, can they deny parole? Yes, they can. And we, oh, go ahead. Hey, this would be your time. So can you be denied parole for refusing to admit to your crime, taking responsibility for it?
Yes. Now let's clear up what we're talking about. We're not talking about, can you be denied release when you've paid your entire debt to society? But in the case where you're being released early, if you got a sentence of 7 to 20 and you've served the 7 and the parole board visits with you and says, well, you're at 7 years and we would like to consider you for parole, but meaning that the other 13 years, you're not going to have to serve behind the walls. Are you willing to acknowledge your transgressions to society? You have absolutely every right to say, no, I'm not. But on the other hand, they have absolutely every right to say, well, you get to stay with us, because they're giving you a privilege of serving the remainder of those 13 years in the community with conditions. Now, when you've served all 20 of those years, they will let you go unless you're in Illinois, because, and not only Illinois, but some states where they have a period of mandatory supervision that follows your sentence. It's a second sentence. But in a case where it's within the same sentence, if you've got a 7 to 20 or 3 to 10 or whatever the case may be, and you do not wish to acknowledge something that you're innocent of doing, you have every right not to acknowledge that. They also have every right to keep you where you are. And that's what they will do in this case in all likelihood.
That would be incredibly hard to do, Larry. Like, you would just be like, you, if you then admit the guilt, then, or I guess not admit the guilt, take responsibility for it, like acknowledge that you did the bad thing, whether you did it or not. You did get convicted of it. I guess that would make the pill easier to swallow, but this would be a tough pill to swallow of saying, yes, I did the bad thing. Okay, well, now you can go. But like, now you've admitted it. Now you're a parole, probation officer, whatever. They're going to say, okay, well, you, I don't know. That would just call into all kinds of doubt about how you got where you are.
So, well, in this particular case, the guy's from Texas and they're pretty tough in Texas, and he's eligible, and they gave him they're going to consider him again in 3 years. And barring some miracle, the answer is going to be the same in 3 years. And he's concerned about his appeal. He's concerned about his appeal. Now, what I'm confused about, because the way I interpreted the letter, he did a plea, which really limits your appellate options. He says, I plead guilty under the 65-year sentence threat. Okay, but see, you've already acknowledged that you did the crime. When the court accepted that guilty plea, there was a factual basis established. You have to establish jurisdiction and sufficient facts that would be covered by that statute that you're about to plead guilty to. You can't just walk in and say, I want to plead guilty without the court establishing that it has subject matter jurisdiction and that the crime occurred within the jurisdiction of the court and that the facts underlying that are sufficient to meet the elements of the crime. And he's admitted to that by his guilty plea. So, right. So I don't understand how, we didn't get the letter. It would have gone on and on if he'd have gone into those details, but he pled guilty, he got a sentence, and now he doesn't want to accept the responsibility, which he accepted with a guilty plea. I feel bad for him. He may have pled guilty because of the threat of the 65 years. Plenty of people do that. But having made that decision, he's already admitted the factual basis existed. It's going to be really tough to undo that, because now he's got to show, the burden is on him to show that the evidence wasn't there, that he was incompetent or something really draconian for him to undo that plea.
And probably past the habeas corpus time frame and things like that?
I don't think Texas has a time limit on habeas, the federal habeas. Okay. Well, he may be past that, but I think Texas is one of those states where you can file a habeas at any time. I think that's what Richard Gladden said one time when we had him on, if I remember right. Don't hold me to it, folks, but I think he did say that.
Let's move over to this forever long article that you posted here from Forbes. It says, the trial penalty and the case against Preston Byrd. What is this about, Larry?
It's about stuff.
All right, cool. You gave me, I guess, sort of like some cheater notes here. It says you had a trial and you wanted to highlight some quotes. It says you had a trial. Why did you decide to fight? Did you think you would win?
Well, the reason why I put it in here is because it shows that the number, it's a long read and most people are not going to want to read it, but it shows the trajectory in terms of the number of people who go to trial over the last several decades. And it was never a large number, but it was comparatively large. At one point, it was 20%. You know, now we're down to 3%. Well, you know, that's a significant decline. But still, at high watermark, you were talking 10 to 20% of the people were going to trial. But without getting political, in the federal system, which I'm going to concentrate on tonight because that's what this case is about. We can talk about states' systems at some other in some other episode. In the federal system in 1984, during the Reagan administration, they changed the practices of federal sentencing. And one of the things they did was the sentencing guidelines. Because before then, they had such a disparity in sentencing where people in a federal courtroom in Alabama versus a federal courtroom in San Francisco. With the exact same crime, the person in Alabama would get a trip to the federal prison, and those liberal pointy-head lifetime judges in San Francisco would give a probated sentence. And that was not justice as far as what the conservatives were saying at the time. They said that we needed to have consistency and uniformity. So they did the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984. They abolished parole. They abolished good time, except for 54 days a year, 15%. And they put this grid system into place in terms of what the sentences would be. And one of the things on the grid is acceptance of responsibility. And you get dinged for going to trial under the sentencing guidelines. There's a trial penalty because that's avoidance of responsibility. Again, trying not to be political, I'm only trying to provide information of what happened. Therefore, from 1984 till now, the low number of people going to trial has even shrunk significantly from that because of this trial penalty, which is what we're talking about tonight. This right. man expected that he was going to get a fair trial. He had no idea anything about sentencing reform. He'd probably never heard of it. He didn't know a system that existed prior to 1984. He may not even be old enough, but if he was old enough, he could care less because he was not a criminal in his mind. So the point of the article is what you find out when you get into the system versus what you thought you knew when you were pledging allegiance to one nation under God with indivisible liberty and justice for all. So that's the reason why I put the article in here is to let people know that sometimes if you just don't believe everything you think, you'll be a whole lot better informed. And this is a guy who recognizes clearly that what he believed wasn't true.
I ran into multiple people who, while guilty of a crime, were much more willing to take whatever plea deal the DA offered versus the potential for the other side. I'm pretty sure I would have mentioned somewhere along the way, my roommate for a period of time, I'm just taking this all at face value, can't verify any of it, so just deal with it. My roommate was convicted of murdering his wife, or ex-wife, maybe it was, and somewhere in there, the DA offered him a 3-year sentence, do one. Georgia has a split sentence thing. They would have reduced it all the way down to whatever that would have qualified for. Instead, he took it to trial and got life, I believe, without parole, and has since passed away in prison after doing 17-ish years.
Well, and I tell the story. I think Grandma Esther has died here in New Mexico, but she did the same thing. She was accused of child molestation. And they offered her probation. She couldn't make bond. And after she'd been in prison for about prison in county jail for 2 years, they offered her probation. Okay. And she said, I ain't taking no probation. I want a lawyer that'll fight for me. So the judge said, all right, well, you want another lawyer? I'll give you another lawyer. It's going to cause your trial to be delayed because this is a complicated case. Well, judge told her, Judge Ross Sanchez said, you're getting a pretty sweetheart deal. You're going to walk out of here today. Well, it is a sweetheart deal if you've done something, but I ain't done nothing. And yeah. So she insisted on her day in court, and she got convicted of every count, and she got 99 years.
And she was already how old, roughly?
Well, her name was Grandma, so you can deduce from that she was she was pretty old. Like I said, I think I might have heard that she's passed away, but if she hasn't passed away, she's in miserable condition because the prisons are not very kind to people in general, and they're very harsh on older people that have infirmaries, that have infirm conditions. And infirmaries actually where you would be in the prison.
And then the second quote you have, so looking back, I also realize the value of creating a working environment that encourages teamwork, fair play, and maintaining a healthy respect for the rule of law. It was my did you already cover this whole part? It sounds like you may have already covered this part.
I wanted to get some quotes from the first part there where he found out that the prosecutor had the prosecutor was vindictive. I think that's something you would never. He went to trial. Just read that quote. Sorry, I went to trial believing that I would win because
okay. Go ahead. So I went to trial believing that I would win because I was naive enough to believe that this justice system would be fair and play by the rules. I was wrong. The prosecutors lied. The prosecutor knew that the man that worked for me committed this crime. He wasn't interested in justice. He was only interested in pursuing me. I later found out that the same prosecutor had been looking into my affair since 2010, trying to find something on me. So he went along with the story of, I told my employee to commit the crime. Even if that had been true, which it was not, the prosecutor knew without a doubt that my employee had committed the crime, but chose not to charge him with anything. That was not justice, it was something else. And cheated throughout the whole process because they wanted a win. They needed a win. I prevailed in civil courts over their buddies. Man, going to civil court, like how much did that cost the dude?
Well, plenty.
Yeah.
And see, he would have been one of like a normal citizen who had been law-abiding, paying his taxes. He would have had no reason to believe that prosecutors would lie. He would have no reason to believe that. He would have believed, as justifiably your neighbors that you get mad at, would believe that the police are overworked, short-staffed, and that the criminals have all the advantages. That's what you've heard. It has been pounded into you. You would never fathom anything like this. And even when we start talking today about maybe reducing some of the resources, they quickly twist that into defunding. And that we're going to let a tidal wave of crime loose on the country. And that scares people to death. And it would scare anybody if you didn't know any of this stuff. And he would have had no reason to know all this because all he was doing was working taxes, paying taxes, trying to get ahead.
And then so the second quote, looking back, I also realize the value of creating a working environment that encourages teamwork, fair play, and maintaining a healthy respect for the rule of law. It was my naive belief that these ideas were understood by all, that they were displayed in actions in our daily interactions with others, that you don't have to tell an adult to be fair or respectful or play by the rules. So taking those ideas for granted, it was never an intentional focus. Having gone through this experience, I now realize it has to be a very intentional conversation that is also reduced to policies, procedures, and protocols.
And that is so well stated because I say that all the time, and I have carried on battles with colleagues. And regardless of whatever business I've been in, that we need to do the right thing. We need to do the right thing. And they say, how do you know the right thing? I said, well, you know what you'd want done to you. And that's how you know when you're doing the right thing. And sometimes you have to push back. You have to push back and say, no, I can't do that. That isn't right.
Yeah. There's a concept that I only learned I call it AP after prison, that it's called the veil of ignorance. So if you, the prosecutor, would be willing to withstand the scrutiny of what you're about to go do to that person, I think that's a decent example. Just to be willing to, if you don't get to pick which side of the argument you're on, you're going to fire up this whole machinery of prosecuting someone. Would you be willing to be on the receiving side of that? And I'd be willing to bet most prosecutors would not be willing to have all the character slander and the microscope on their lives the way that gets put forth. And maybe things would go a little bit less aggressive if they considered that mindset.
Absolutely. That was addressed in the article. He talked about the perp walk and all the press conferences and the stuff that they did to him. And again, sometimes you have to say, boss, I'm sorry, I can't do this. This is not right. And believe me.
But Larry, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. That's the expression.
Right. Well, believe me, if you do this, your life will not end. You have value as a human being. You will survive this even if they do terminate you, and they might not terminate you. You're assuming and projecting what they're going to do. But try standing up and saying, no, I can't do this. This is not right, and see what happens. You might be surprised. They might be so in awe that someone cares enough about ethics, they might actually back off and say, I had never thought of that.
I think you would be on the short list to get fired.
Well, that has happened, but not for that reason.
Okay, let's move over to the Washington Post. It says, Amy Coney Barrett, potential, not anymore, potential Supreme Court nominee, wrote an influential ruling on campus sexual assault. This is one of your hot buttons, is the due process part of things where people in schools are accused of things and they're pretty much guilty just by accusation alone without all the due process and protections for the defense.
It is indeed, and I think it should be for everyone. I'm flabbergasted, and people say I'm in denial on things. I can't understand why anyone who could call themselves a patriotic American who claims that they believe in the Constitution, how you could believe anything other than what we stand for as a nation. We stand for the presumption of innocence. We stand for the burden of proof being on the prosecution. We stand for the accused not having to take the stand or prove anything. And these are our central values in America. In this case, I pulled it today. I was not aware of it. I read it with some diligence. It's 30 pages. It's in the show notes. And I can't find anything whatsoever wrong with what Judge Barrett wrote or the analysis of the three-judge panel. It is absolutely, completely spot on every point. So to those out there who think that I have an axe to grind, I know you're out there. I don't see anything wrong with this decision. Now, having said that, there are a whole lot of decisions that I don't have any knowing about what she has written, but this isn't one where she deserves any condemnation. This is spot on.
And this is about the men in these trials being discriminated against and siding just with the woman, the female, most likely the female, because it probably doesn't always end up that way, but somebody makes the accusation and then the dude is just automatically guilty, probably restricted from individual classes, if not restricted from the entire campus.
That is correct. This was Purdue University, and this was a case where there had been a romantic relationship, and this heightened awareness of assault, campus assault, and the directive from the Obama administration to make it so that we can find more validation of and find more support for what everybody knows is happening and just rampantly on campus, which there probably is some truth to that. I've been around campuses enough to know all the partying and the people in drunken stupor. But what they did, I mean, when you're drunk and stupor, you can't be totally at yourself in terms of your behavior. That doesn't excuse your behavior, but people do crazy stuff when they're drinking. But this case didn't come close to anything that resembled due process. When you read through this, you would be shocked that this could happen in America. They did not let the guy have the statement until the day of the hearing. He didn't have any chance to prepare any witnesses to call in rebuttal. Two of the three on the panel said they didn't need to hear from him, that they hadn't read the complaint, that they already knew where they were going. Now, this is based on what he said in his complaint, and since the federal court below dismissed it summarily without a hearing, the appellate court can only review his complaint as if everything he said was true. But they didn't give him anything that would approximate any type of due process. He had a witness to call. They didn't want to hear from the witness. They didn't even need to allow her to come to the hearing. They said that her statement was sufficient. So he wasn't able to have any type of confrontation. He was denied a continuation of his education. He was kicked out of the ROTC based on the finding of the university, which they held that there was substantial evidence that clear and convincing, I forget what level of evidence, but they found that there was enough evidence, and they found him essentially guilty in their kangaroo court, and then he got booted out of the ROTC, and they banned him from campus for a year until he wow. until he got and like I say, this is they go right down through the legal analysis, they go through the standards. The one of his claims about the well-established qualified immunity exists unless there is clearly established precedent, and he was trying to strip qualified immunity, and they denied that. They said that one of these precedents was not clearly established, so therefore it wouldn't have been known. But I looked through this and I can't find any reason. If you're evaluating her on this decision alone, you cannot right. find fault with this, unless you believe that a person is not entitled to due process, that they're not entitled to any presumption of innocence, that they're not entitled to confront anybody, that you can strip them of their privileges, of their education. If you believe in that, then this decision is exactly what you would like. But that's not America that I want to live in.
Yeah. Can you remind me of the different levels of evidence, and like you clear and convincing you just said, or reasonable doubt? Can you quickly run through those just as a reminder for folks?
Well, it's preponderance was the one I was looking for, which is tipping the scale okay. slightly more than 50%. They found by preponderance of the evidence.
Okay. You also use clear and convincing?
Clear and convincing is the next level of stronger evidence. And then the beyond a reasonable doubt is for a criminal proceeding where they're actually going to be suffering criminal penalties. He was not suffering a criminal penalty here. This was not going to be his punishment. This, in terms of a period of incarceration or anything like that, this was to determine how the campus would respond. And the campus decided that the best thing to do would be to strip him of his education. If this is all you've got, then you need to come up with something else, because this isn't it.
I do understand. And so those show notes, that case will be in the show notes as well. Let's move over to another article from the Washington Post. It says, Kentucky GOP lawmaker indicted on assault, accused of strangling woman with an Ethernet cable. That sounds pretty harsh, Larry. Why did you put this in here?
Well, because it blends right into what we just talked about.
Okay.
There's all these shrill demands that he resign. But the only problem is he hasn't been convicted of anything. Now, let's be clear. He's a Republican, and it doesn't okay. change the analysis at all. He's entitled to the presumption of innocence, and that presumption follows him through the duration of this proceeding until he decides to either change his plea to guilty or until a court finds him guilty. If he chooses to remain in office and present himself for re-election, if he's up for re-election right now, I didn't get that deep into it, but if he is, that's for the voters to decide. But he should not be forced to resign because of these accusations. Now, there is some irony. He was a big proponent of the strangulation bill, which is part of what is causing him problems now, because he's being charged under that. The criminal justice victims advocates are trying to expand the definition of what constitutes a strangulation. And they want it to be so loose that if anybody gets near your throat, it's an attempted strangulation. It's kind of like the okay. thing with the human trafficking. If you define everything as human trafficking, that's what they're trying to do with strangulation. Well, yeah, we didn't fall for that here. They came to with their language, and to the credit, our legislature scrapped their language, and they actually designed something that approximates a real strangulation. You know, but that's not what they want. Because strangulation is serious, and it is serious. If you're being deprived of oxygen, it's very serious. But
yes, it doesn't take long for that to end.
Yes, it can be very dangerous in a very short period of time. So I'm not minimizing strangulation, but you don't call it strangulation just because you want to subject a person to a more severe penalty. If they hold a scarf and they hold it in front of you and say, "You better do what I tell you, or else," they haven't strangled you. Right. Nor have they attempted to.
Well, I've heard that used with kidnapping. It was like, "Get in the car." Well, no. Now you've already attempted kidnapping because you forcefully demanded someone move from their current location.
So, well, I have this strange, crazy belief that if you're going to call something strangulation, there ought to be some strangulation happening.
Suppose you're not successful at it and you are thwarted in your attempts.
But I would like to see that there actually some attempt to do strangulation.
Sure.
Words are not enough. I would like to have all the money that there is in the banks on the weekends. But that doesn't make me guilty. That doesn't make me guilty of bank robbery.
Man, I was in with you on that plan. Wait, how can we execute on this? Do we need any help from anybody?
But anyway, that's the point of this, is that he is innocent in the eyes of the law. Don't lose sight of that. It's our burden as the prosecution to show that he is not innocent. It's not for us to conjecture. He can decide to plead guilty if he chooses to. He can decide to do what the article above. He can go to trial and see what happens. Now, he wanted to weaken the evidentiary standard and proof. It would be sad if it actually comes back to bite him. His own work comes back to bite him. But he is entitled to nothing less, and it doesn't change one iota according to his political party.
And I don't think you touched on this. He's accused of doing this more than a decade ago. I don't know what the statute of limitations would be on this type of thing in Kentucky, but it might have already passed that. So this is just another hit job, sort of like the, Roy Moore in Alabama from 40 years ago or whatever.
Yeah, I didn't even pick up on that.
I just happened to be scrolling through and saw that.
Well, that's why you get paid the big bucks.
Yeah, I guess so. Is there anything else before we move on to RBG?
No, I think we can move on. We're making good time. We'll be out of here before you know it.
Before you know it, until we get to the one that's going to like train wreck this whole thing. So this is from the Marshall Project, and this is RBG's mixed record on race and criminal justice. The subtitle is, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a revered feminist icon. Her legacy on issues such as prisoners' rights, capital punishment, racial justice, and tribal sovereignty has been less examined. And you put this in here. Why?
Well, I think that my main motivation was that her original appointment was, there was some vilification that she was a liberal ACLU do-gooder, and she's been characterized as a liberal. This is a very, very long read, and I would encourage people to read it. When you read it, you'll find out that as a jurist, she wasn't nearly as liberal as what you would like to think. She just truly wasn't. On some things, she was a little bit on the conservative side. So go through these, and the takeaway is that you're not going to agree with a justice on all issues. You don't agree with your wife unless you're Andy on everything. But you're not going to agree with.
It's just a smart move, man. I'm telling you, it's just a smart move.
but you're not going to agree with them on everything. But some of the vilification and the shrill criticism that you're hearing in the case of Coney Barrett may be over-dramatization. And what you've heard about how horrible Ruth Bader Ginsburg and how horrible the liberal wing of the court is, you may be getting a false narrative. Because looking through this, she just really wasn't all that liberal on a lot of things.
Which I think you could also then transpose that to say that maybe Amy Coney Barrett wouldn't be as conservative on all things.
That's where I'm headed with that. What we are hearing may be a hit job, and it may be accurate. But I've lived long enough. I remember the anxiety that unelected President Ford went through when he appointed John Paul Stevens to succeed the liberal Justice William O. Douglas, who was a liberal, unquestionably a liberal. When Ford was given that appointment, which the Democrat Party did not attempt to stop him from having, even though he was never elected president or vice president, he was given that appointment, and he turned out to be a very fine justice. And in fact, he turned out to be more of a liberal than anyone ever imagined. Is it possible that the same thing could happen here? Sure, it's possible. It absolutely is.
Yeah, we talk about pretty regularly of looking at someone in their totality, and I know that the abortion debate is something that will always poison the well, and like you just have to stop on that thing. But you would try and gather as much information as you could on their history, what they have said publicly at speeches, or how they, what their actual voting record is. And, you know, you have a pros and cons column. Maybe they vote this way for this, and this is something that you're in favor of, and they go against you, and they vote in favor of this different thing, but that doesn't go along with what you believe. That takes a lot of work, Larry. Maybe we need someone to help us actually do that so that we could just be push button voters.
Well, unfortunately, on this, I don't really want to have an abortion debate on the podcast, but there's a strong base on the conservative side that analysis you're talking about, they're not willing to do. That is the issue for them.
Yeah.
They do not care about anything else, because to them, if you're on the wrong side of abortion, I don't want to hear any more. I don't want to hear any more. I don't care if you're bringing me the right side of 80% of what I believe in. If you're not against abortion, you don't deserve. That's just the reality of, and we're not going to be able to change that. Those voters are going to go to the polls in November, thinking that they've got a staunch anti-abortion. The only thing that they're missing in this is that even though that may be her personal opinion, she may be able to separate her personal opinion from the reality of what the Constitution has been interpreted, and the fact that that interpretation has been around for approximately 50 years now. And she may disappoint you, just like Justice Roberts has disappointed so many people. She may come as a surprise to you that her personal belief may be how she decides the case when the inevitable abortion question is presented to the court, and it will be. They will accelerate every cert petition that can be imagined on anything related to abortion. They're going to file those because in their mind, they've got a 6-3 solid majority after this confirmation is complete, and this is going to end Roe versus Wade once and for all, and that's what they want to see happen.
I hear you. Let's see here. And this is Marshall Project always writes almost Atlantic level length articles. It is a long one if you want to get a pretty deep insight into RBG's history.
You might find she wasn't as liberal as you thought.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
And moving on, I will play this clip and then we will talk about.
Let's set it up before we play the clip. This confirmation process, I predicted, would not happen. I was clearly wrong. It is going to happen. It's going to happen over, apparently, what, if you can believe polling data, is over the objection of the American people, that a strong majority feel that there should not be a confirmation. I don't recollect that it's ever happened this close to an election. I know that in 2016, in February, it was too close to an election, and I know that that's changed as far as the hypocrisy of those who are making the decisions now. The standard they set in 2016 is no longer the standard now. But that being said, it is going to likely happen. They're going to accelerate all the processes, and they've set it up because Amy will be someone who's been previously been vetted, so they don't have to do as much vetting.
And yeah, just 3 years ago, she got put on the federal bench.
Yeah, so that's going to cut out some of the stuff that they would normally have had to do. But there's going to be deep emotional. It's going to scar the country again. We're going to have division. And the reason why I put this clip in here, because again, it's almost 50 years old. And it was from a president who left office recognizing how great the country is and how we should put pettiness aside. Those who win this confirmation, they're going to be happy. And those who feel their voices weren't heard and they feel that the rules were changed, they're going to be very angry. I would not be surprised to see protest. I wouldn't be surprised to maybe even see some violence. And I hope that doesn't happen, but it would not surprise me. But I would encourage you to don't do that. Don't hate the people personally. Don't wish ill to them as far as bad things happen to them, their personal safety. Register your resentment against them at the polls. Your senator in Kentucky is up for election. He's the one who's changed the rules. That is what you do. And that's why I have this clip here. Rather than being hurt and violent, just remember what President Nixon said on his final day in office. He said to his staff, this is a very short clip.
Always give your best. Never get discouraged. Never be petty. Always remember, others may hate you. But those who hate you don't win unless you hate them. And then you destroy yourself.
Very short clip.
Yeah, let's don't destroy ourselves over this. Let's do our best, and those who are happy will rejoice, and those who are hurt about what happens, let's do our best to change the trajectory of going forward. And you can do that at the polls. You've got 1/3 of the United States Senate up for re-election, and you've got a presidential election, and this is where in America, we do our expression of dissatisfaction. We don't burn things. We don't engage in violence. We shouldn't even hate people who we disagree with. We should change those who are there in those positions. That's what I encourage people to do.
And where we're coming from on this is an article from the New York Times that talks about the Supreme Court, how a Supreme Court justice is usually appointed, that it usually takes many months. And Larry, even with that, maybe they don't get it done by the time of Election Day. There's still a very comfortable amount of time before Inauguration Day. It takes normally like 70-ish or 80-ish days, somewhere like close to the three-month range. We're definitely 3 months away from Inauguration Day. And as you've been pointing out, you're president for exactly how long?
Well, unless your name is Obama, you're president for the entire term. this is correct. Now, generally, in a lame duck session, you would not do anything this controversial because some of these people will not be reelected. Some will, but some won't. So normally, a lame duck session, you do clean up legislation. You finalize things that must be done before the new Congress comes in. But there would be the potential to come back and finish this process in the lame duck. But under the McConnell-Graham rules, this would not have been done because they said unequivocally, we played clips, there's no need to go through that. They said that in a presidential election year, the American people should be allowed to weigh in. And the American people are not being allowed to weigh in on this. And that's really disappointing because you don't know how to play the game if the rules constantly change. And the rules changed in a very short period of time.
Why do you say American people?
Because that's the way I've heard the people that are pushing for this pronounce it.
I'm pretty sure that's how McConnell actually says it. I ended up with a pretty long conversation. I wasn't really in the mood to like keep going about it. He pointed to all kinds of differences. Like they have the power to do it. Therefore they did it with the advice and consent, blah, blah, blah. Obama did the nomination. He did his duty. And then the Senate had the privilege, I guess you could say, they had the authority to then go, nah, we don't like that person. And they didn't do anything with it. Here they are in agreement with the person that has been nominated this go around, and they're going to go everything through. Like they're within their authority, power, whatever. They're justified in doing this the way that they are doing it and did it. I think that's what the person's arguments were.
Well, the only problem with that logic was that they did not give the person even a hearing. They did not even let them make the rounds on the Capitol to give them the consideration. I think he was allowed into the Capitol after his nomination, but the normal meetings that they have and the normal the normal processes weren't followed. You can't give advice and consent if you refuse to consider the person. That's not really advice and consent. And that was just obstructionism. And I know right. that they're trying really hard to explain it. And they've come up with a theory that if the Senate and the president are of the same party, then the seat doesn't belong to the American people at that point. But see, the whole doctrine of it belonging to the American people was phony to start with, because the American people entrusted the previous president with 4 years and then another 4 years. And that seat opened up early in the final year. But there was almost a year left of the presidency, almost a complete year, 11 months left. And they yes. pulled that out of their you-know-what. That it belonged to the American people. The American people had already decided when they voted that was one of the things that the president would be nominating Supreme Court justices should any open. That was a seat that they, by all actuality, they did not. That was not a seat that should have been held open. Now, if an unqualified nominee had been put forward, and they had done the vetting, and the votes weren't there, that would have been a whole different situation. They could have held the hearings and said, well, sorry, you don't have votes.
Right, because, I mean, they held the majority in 16 at the time that this happened, didn't they?
That is correct. But see, they would have had a hard time. He was already sitting on the D.C. Court of Appeals and a well-respected jurist. They would have had a hard time voting him down. So the easiest chicken cop-out way was to never have a vote, because it would be very hard. It's the same position they've got now, because they've got a person sitting on the Seventh Circuit who's been vetted just very recently. And so now you have to take an 80 to 14 or whatever it was, 80 to 16 confirmation, which obviously included some Democrats, significant number of Democrats. Now you've got to turn around and say, well, we were wrong. She's not fit for the federal judiciary. That's not going to happen. Sure. I mean, that would have happened with Merrick Garland. That's the reason why they didn't have the vote.
Of course. Of course, of course. Anything else?
I think we've beat that to death.
Very good. And now that I try and pull it up, Larry, I tried to pull it up just as we were doing pre-show. There was a subreddit that I follow. It's called SO Support. I don't like using the actual full term of sex offender, but so it's SO Support. Has 1,600 members, and somebody decided to pop in there, I think it was roughly yesterday, and called out a particular politician in New York and just said, very, very nasty. Like, I hate this person. This person should die because they made SO laws worse for our people. And I also want to counter that with over on the Narsal Connection site, the social media platform. I want to give that a little bit of a plug. If you're not on there, you should head over there. I posted a positive quote from the former governor, and, there was a quote from the governor about it was just a positive affirmation kind of question or a statement. And so somebody immediately writes back and is like, I don't like him because he signed the tougher sex offender laws. And I was like, well, we are the ones that vote for the politicians. The governor or the politician directly didn't do it on their own. And I got cussed out and all this stuff after all this. And I wanted you to explain it in a very edumacated sense on how these things go about getting all the way to the governor or the president's desk, like IML. How do we go from someone making the claim to make these laws tougher or less tough and go through that process where, this person's calling out this particular one politician for doing the bad thing?
Well, it's a conversation that we'll have relentlessly and repeatedly, because people mistake the veto power. And theoretically, a veto power does exist. But a veto is not realistic to expect when something passes unanimously or close to unanimously, because generally the override margin is 2/3. And if it passes unanimously, you can clearly see that 2/3 is less than unanimous, right?
Yes.
Okay, so what you're dealing with when you have something passed unanimously or close to unanimously is something where a veto would be futile. And yes, you do possess the power. So we can go through President Clinton could have vetoed the Megan's Law in 94. President Bush could have. He possessed the power in 2006 to veto the Adam Walsh Act. and President Obama possessed the power to veto international Megan's Law. You could move any of those presidents to any of those different eras, and it wouldn't have changed anything. You could put Obama in place of Clinton or Bush in place of Clinton, and they will sign those because they come to them. As far as the president is concerned, that's one of the few things when you get something where there's nearly unanimous support. And it comes to them as far as they're concerned. At first blush, there's no problem with it because when the people's representatives conclude that there's no reason to oppose something, that gives an executive heart palpitations. Well, I get to sign something where there's almost unanimous agreement. So you don't spend the same amount of diligence looking at something that has unanimous consent. I mean, just think about that. When it goes to the executive desk, the tallies, they're looking at the executive. It passed unanimously. Oh, well, it must be pretty good stuff. And then even if someone tells you, well, there's actually a couple of problems in here that caused some consternation, but ultimately they were disregarded, then the president or the chief executive has to do a calculation of, do I want to try to muster the support for a veto to sustain my veto? A veto is worthless if it's going to be overridden. So when you do a veto, right, when you issue a veto, what you're doing is you're standing in the way, you're standing between the American people, the citizens of Georgia, whatever state, and what they have decided that they want as a matter of public policy. And you're saying, as the ultimate check and balance, I am going to stand in the way of this because I know best. And you don't want your veto to be overridden. At that point, you go looking for votes because you're trying to prevent the supermajority from materializing. And when you go looking for those votes, trying to find them becomes increasingly difficult depending on what the issue is, because you automatically have to write off the opposing party. If you're a Democratic president, you're not going to generally find a lot of Republican votes to sustain your veto. Because for the opposing party, it's a way of weakening the executive power. If you can override the executive on this, what else can we override the executive on? So you've just diminished your pool for trying to get to that one third plus one. You've diminished it by 50% right away because you're not going to likely get any from the opposing party. Then you have to lean within your own caucus to try to find one third, knowing that the other side is going to vilify them. And that's a tough sell, because something like international Megan's Law, something like being tougher on sex offenders, the opposing party is not going to just stand down and say, oh, well, the president felt pretty strongly about that, so we'll just keep that kind of low key. We'll forget all about that he vetoed that. They're not going to do that. And it's become a very significant campaign issue, and it's just not realistic to expect a veto on this type of thing. So the lesson in it is you can't allow it to get to the executive. If it gets to the executive, it's too late. It's going to be signed. And I challenge anyone out there to show me a significant piece of criminal justice legislation that got vetoed in any state that would have cracked down. Now, you can show me somewhere it would have made things better, but show me something where they were increasing penalties on prison sentences that got vetoed, and you're going to be hard pressed to find it. It just doesn't happen, because realistically, that's going to be politically devastating to veto that. The governor, he was a Republican. It got to his desk. He was going to sign it. If it had gotten to Jerry right. Brown's desk, he would have signed it.
Sure. And my whole point was that these things don't happen in isolation. The person, you know, the governor, any politician that is under the gun for these things, the public is super duper in favor of these things because it makes them feel better, regardless of what the recidivism rate, regardless of if it's effective or not. The public is in favor of these things. Then they're going, if that person wants to be reelected next go around, then they have to support it. I mean, maybe not that one issue would sink their ship, but I mean, it could, because then you end up with all the attack ads from the other side. Oh, this person was not in favor of making the lives of the PFRs worse. There's no political cover for them on this issue. So you would have to use all the back channel kind of politicky things that you talk about to thwart these things from getting to a vote on the floor, to get to the executive's desk.
That is correct. And when you say the vilification, let's be clear, the vilification normally comes from the conservative side. Again, I issue the challenge. Show me a Democrat who is vilifying a Republican for criminal justice, positive reform, and we will call that person out on this program. It just doesn't happen. Now, they do vilify Republicans for other things. I'm not saying that they're pure as the wind-driven snow. But on criminal justice reform, it is a one-sided vilification. It's the Republicans and the conservatives who vilify the liberal Democrats for wanting to turn loose a tidal wave of crime. We can't fix that problem if we don't admit that it exists. And I strongly believe that if you are in denial about what the problem is, you really can't come to a solution. The problem is on criminal justice reform, as what happened in the First Step Act, the conservative Republicans led by Senator Tom Cotton watered down the First Step Act. That is the reality of what happened. It's not me attacking Tom Cotton. I'm just simply telling you what he did. So,
anything else before we move on? I think we've covered that pretty well.
So yes, I don't think that the justification of Governor Schwarzenegger is fair at all. And we'll see if the computer can understand Schwarzenegger and spell it.
I bet it does. I totally bet that the transcription will pick up Schwarzenegger. And just to take one tiny, I don't have a question that you said for the girl's question. I don't have it anywhere, Larry.
Okay, well, I do.
Okay.
So this is from Jim.
I don't see a PDF of it. I don't see it in the show notes. Oh, that question. Never mind. Yep. I know what question you're talking about. Oh, so, okay, never mind. So one of our patrons, a long, 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 long time patron, sent an email about, I don't want to divulge too much information, about someone close to her trying to figure out where to begin, trying to some removal from the registry, becoming an advocate, and so forth. And I asked you to try and address this as much as you can. Now I know what you're talking about.
And I agree. I don't want to divulge too much, but there is a potential of deregistration because some states still have a process. And what has to be done is that an individual analysis has to be done on that particular person's offenses. For example, he already reached out to a Colorado attorney, and the Colorado attorney said no. And I'm guessing that probably because there might have been more than one count. In Colorado, the deregistration is only available if you have one count, not one conviction, but multiple counts, but just one count. I'm guessing there was more than one count in that conviction. But now that the person's off supervision, there would be that potential. Now, we try not to engage in state shopping on the air because that would be devastating to the state. But on the other hand, the processes that are out there do exist, and people who are shopping for a legal representation, they deserve the best representation they can get. And if we can help them find the best representation they can get, that is all the better, as far as I'm concerned. But I don't know enough at this point to give any advice other than I promise I will reach out and get more information in the coming week or so, and we'll talk about it. But yes, there might be a way off the registry, and I certainly don't see any. Who would want to be on the registry if they don't have to be?
I think I would like to stay on it just indefinitely, just because it feels fun.
Well, but everybody, please understand, only the state that releases you from registration can release you from their obligations. If you leave that sanctuary, you could find yourself back on the registry. And that is just so hard for people to comprehend. I get emails all the time, and I say all the time, that's like an exaggeration, but I get regular emails about, I don't understand, I got off the registry in this state and now I'm back. Or I think I'm going to have to be back. And yes, that is absolutely true. You may find yourself back.
Because of the way the language is, if you've ever been convicted of a whatever, wherever, it doesn't matter, you will be registering here.
That is correct. Or it might be that their look back period is so long that it might encompass your conviction. We've got states that go back to the 1950s and 60s and 70s. So it may not be has ever, but it may be effectively has ever been convicted because your crime occurred in the last 40 years. And that could catch you. Or if you have a if you've ever had a duty to register. There's just all sorts of things that can trip you up in having to register again. So my advice to you, if you're going to state shop, find a state that you can actually stay in for the rest of your days. Otherwise, you're wasting your money. If you're trying to go state shop to get off the registry thinking you can end up somewhere else, it doesn't work that way.
Okay. Well, so Larry, very exciting. We got two new patrons this week, and that is James and Christopher, which I'm super excited about to get two more. We're getting close to that 1,000 person threshold that we've been trying to achieve for so long.
Is that right? 1,000?
Yes. Pick whatever number we're trying to reach. 1,000 is one of the thresholds we would try to reach. Do you agree with that?
I agree, but we've got a little ways to go.
Yes, we do. But also, Christopher wrote an incredibly, incredibly nice message that I asked permission to read because Anyway, didn't want to call a person out for giving too much information, but it says, I have needed to travel a lot for work, driving many, many hours. I have been binge listening to your show, and they are incredible. Sometimes it makes me want to add another 100 miles to my trip, which is kind of funny on its own, to drive an extra 100 miles just to listen to me and Larry banter. But with 2 million people plus directly and indirectly involved in the registry, this podcast could and should be a unifying force with great numbers. I will try and help spread the word. As time goes on, I hope to raise my monthly contribution as costs towards other things in my life begin to wane. Larry has an incredible grasp and articulation of the legal machinations regarding this ridiculous sex offense laws, and his banter with Andy makes for very compelling listening. Larry and Andy, please keep up the great work. Christopher, thank you, thank you, thank you a million times over. Thank you for that. That's super sweet. That'll probably end up on the website as a testimony. And again, I appreciate it very much.
That is very kind. And keep us informed when he raises his donation, because he's already at 1,000.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, he's totally like turning the lights on, and you're getting ready to quit your day job because of the contribution.
and we had the priest show. I really don't know how much people I know. Use the names of patrons, but I never scour the list. If you're a patron, it's fantastic. Anywhere from any level that you're supporting us, it's just touching. So I generally don't know how much anyone's giving.
I know it's wonderful. It's very nice. It's a stress reliever, I guess. But it is we're trying to reach as many people as possible. But we definitely appreciate it, and it makes it inspires and encourages us to do it that much more and put out a good product.
Well, yeah, there is some work goes into this. Some people go out and party on Saturday, but other people on this team actually spend Saturday working on the show.
Yes, there is an immense amount of work that goes into this. You probably don't know this, but I spend 6-ish hours in post-production, probably.
I was going to say, Dal, on Sunday, it flips after the podcast because I spend more time in prep than you do, but then you spend a whole lot of time in post-show that I don't have to deal with.
Yes, I do. But you remember last week we were talking kind of silly about coming up with names for the nonprofit entity?
I do.
And so our super patron Mike came up he gave us 12, and somehow 12 is missing, so he gave us 13, but there's one missing. And I wanted to read some of them, because one of the funniest ones to me is the Center for Registration and Compliance Information. That one really triggers me, and it says, the Andy Show featuring the guy from the Lincoln administration, Sir Larry Talks a Lot. Those are my two favorites. Have any that you wanted to highlight?
They were all funny as far as I was concerned. We've got some creative people out there.
Yes, we do. FYP Industries for PFRs who got screwed by the man. Thank you, Mike, so very much. These made me laugh. They're funny.
So yeah, we've got some creative people beyond names. We've got some creative people that can put together quite a production, and I'm looking forward to when that gets distributed to our patrons.
What production?
I've heard of a production of what happens when you get the knock at the door.
Oh, that production. Yeah, see, Larry, we're supposed to keep that on the down low.
Oh, really? Okay, well, then let's strike that from the record.
Yes, I will remove that. Don't tell anybody. There may be a little video clip coming out very soon. I think that about wraps it up, Larry, unless there was something else that we missed, I think.
Fantastic. I think we're fitting within our page limit. You know, we now have an arbitrary page limit of 16 pages.
I thought it was 18.
16.
Is it 16? Okay. Yep. 16 it is. Yeah, I'm sure we have about another 5 minutes. Do you want to ramble for another five?
Nope.
Okay. Well, we record the show usually live on Saturday night, 7 p.m. Eastern. You know, Larry, I had a conversation with someone yesterday talking about I was going to get together with him on Monday, and he's in the Eastern Texas time, so he's in Central Time Zone. And so I said, can we meet at 2? And he goes, okay, that's 3 p.m. my time. And I was like, no, that's not. And he even like extended it out, and he's like, well, that would be 4 p.m. this time and 5. I was like, wait a minute, man, you are so, it would be an hour behind. Anyway, I will continue. Patrons can listen to us record the show live, but if you can't listen live, you can always do so on demand, which is the whole point anyway, to listen on demand. We want to make this available to you at your convenience. And if you do me a favor and subscribe your podcast app, if when you subscribe, you're sending a signal to them that you want this material, and maybe it would suggest things to other people that are listening to similar things. And, but you know, we even have a YouTube channel, and subscribe there as well. You can also sign up on our email newsletter to get notified when the episodes come out. And you will get this promptly Tuesday morning. And you can find all of that stuff at registrymatters.co. Larry, phone number?
747-227-4477. I think.
And the email address? I think you got it right.
That would be registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And of course, we love all of our listeners, and but the patrons are near and dear to our heart. Where do people go to support the podcast directly?
That would be patreon.com, patreon.com/registrymatters.
As always, Larry, you are an abundance of information, and I greatly appreciate it and enjoy the time we spend. Thank you very much, and have a great weekend.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.